Water.
Privatization.
Electricity.
Privatization.
Healthcare.
Privatization.
Education.
Privatization.
What happens when corporations treat those public services as commodities to be bought and sold on the open market? And how are people in Canada and around the world protecting the public sphere and resisting corporate greed?
It's coming by leaps and bounds.
Thousands of people die because this economic model was imposed to war.
It is not sustainable, and we have an opportunity to stop it now.
You're listening to Conning the People, a five-part documentary series about privatization in Canada in an international context.
I'm Asad Ismi.
I'm Kristen Schwartz.
We'll be investigating the effects of privatization globally and locally on healthcare, education, electricity, and water.
Stay tuned for the next half hour as we examine the pitfalls of privatizing Canada's water system. We'll highlight the role of water multinationals and check out the effects of water privatization in Bolivia and Britain.
Private water has not worked anywhere in the world, and nobody wants it here. These people are here tonight. They're here tonight to tell you. These people are here tonight to tell you that there are problems with this pathway that you're on. You should listen to them, get off the pathway, get back to public, at cost, non-profit water.
More than 1.2 billion people around the world lack access to fresh drinking water today, and it is projected that by 2025, the demand for fresh water will outstrip supply by more than 50%. Transnational corporations are poised to take advantage of this crisis for profit. They view water as a commodity to be bought, sold, traded, and diverted according to market demands. Backed by the World Bank, these companies have been taking over public water systems in many third world countries. They have also been moving into water sectors in industrialized countries, especially Britain and the United States. Canada has the cheapest water in the world and an effective public water system. However, as with healthcare and education, the federal government has deprived the water sector of funds by not renewing the National Infrastructure Program that expired in 1998. This has encouraged the takeover of water services by multinational corporations as cash-strapped municipalities scramble to fund the extension of water systems.
The Walkerton tragedy in 2000 showed that privatization of water management literally kills. Seven people died in Walkerton, Ontario, and thousands more were made ill from drinking tainted water because of a combination of downloading, deregulation, inadequate training, and privatization. Water privatization has also had damaging results worldwide, sparking mass protests in Bolivia and Peru and bringing massive price increases in the Czech Republic, Philippines, and Britain. Tony Clark is director of the Polaris Institute and co-author with Maud Barlow of Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World's Water. He comments on the famous statement of Ismail Sarageldin, a vice president of the World Bank, that the wars of the 21st century will be fought over water.
If we look at between now and the year 2025, somewhere in the neighborhood of two-thirds of the population on this planet will be facing some form of water scarcity, and demand for water will outstrip supply by something like 56%. Once that happens, there is likely to be much more tension and conflict built up over water. Insofar as supply becomes scarce, then, of course, market forces start to intensify, and therefore those that have the ability to pay can have access to water. Those that do not have the ability to pay will not have access to water, and that is the rule that the market usually operates under. And just as oil was the black gold of the 20th century, we're likely to see water become the blue gold of the 21st century.
Canada's blue gold is a prime target for export schemes. Major export deals to send Canadian water to the U.S. have been proposed in Quebec, British Columbia, Newfoundland, and Ontario.
It goes back to the early 1980s when there were plans put in place for something like the Grand Canal Scheme, which would take northern river systems in Quebec and and reverse the flow of those northern river systems to flow southward through a system of canals into the Great Lakes, and then flushing the water from there into the American Midwest and other parts of the United States which were in need of water. There's also the North American Water Power Authority, NOAAPA, in British Columbia, where northern river systems in British Columbia would be, again, the flow would be of these river systems would be reversed to bring water into a crater in the Rocky Mountains, and then flushing that water through pipe systems down into the state of Washington, and from there into the American Midwest. So these kind of schemes have been on the books for some time for plans to take bulk water from Canada and export it. And so far these schemes have not been put in place because a great deal of financing would be involved, and the demand needs to be much more pronounced perhaps than it is at the present time.
NAFTA makes water exports irreversible.
The first time that a jurisdiction in Canada allows bulk water to actually be shipped or transferred in bulk form and exported, once that happens, then NAFTA is triggered, and there's no turning back. There was an attempt in Newfoundland at Lake Gisborne to actually allow for the bulk water exports there, and the government of Newfoundland came very close to making that decision to do so. And the same thing almost happened in the Great Lakes. In Lake Ontario, there was an attempt to, again, transfer bulk water out of Lake Ontario. And the green light had been given on that, then we would have seen a major change in the whole relationship of water flows between Canada and the United States. Many of us have been involved in calling for a national ban on the part of the Canadian government for bulk water exports. At least on a for-profit basis. It doesn't mean to say that we can't be looking at the ways of sharing water across borders, but we have to put a halt to any attempt for companies to come in and take this natural water and ship it from one natural basin to another simply to make a profit on it.
Determined to control water on a world level are three major corporations, Vivendi Environmental and Suez-Leonez, both French multinationals, and Germany's RWE. Vivendi is the largest water multinational in the world, followed by Suez. Between them, they control 70% of the global water market. Vivendi has 110 million customers in 100 countries. Suez controls the water systems of 110 million people in 130 countries. In France, both Suez and Vivendi have been repeatedly cited for corruption. The French town of Grenoble regained public control of its water system in 2000 after a 10-year struggle to expose the corruption and bribery Suez had used to take over the system. Senior managers of the company's subsidiary and the mayor were sent to prison. Large price increases, declines in services, and health problems have dogged Suez's operations in Australia, Britain, Morocco, South Africa, Argentina, and Indonesia.
One of the things we say to people is that take a look at what the track record of these companies has been, and in many instances it's been very poor. Take, for example, Suez and its operations in the Buenos Aires when it took over the water system there in Buenos Aires. The water rates escalated within just over a year, went up something like 103-104%, and profit rates also went up for the company. The company was securing profit rates at something like 28-30% in the first few years of its operations there. But meanwhile, it didn't meet its targets. There's a contract, and it had targets to meet with regards to its extension of sewage and wastewater services. It didn't meet those targets. And there were all sorts of problems of raw sewage and things like that going into the water systems.
In 2002, Suez-Leonez got the biggest wastewater contract in North America for sewage systems in Halifax through its subsidiary, United Water. Vivendi Environmental has faced similar criticisms about corruption. According to Public Citizen, a U.S. watchdog, quote, "The risk of hooking up with Vivendi has become more profound as financial shenanigans place even further doubt on the corporation's ability to run a water and sewer system safely, affordably, and in the public interest."
I think one of the most, you know, extraordinary examples of problems has occurred with Vivendi's operations in Puerto Rico, where it took over the water system there, and they found out that there were major problems in the running of the system. They had a huge increase in the debt load from something like $260 million to well over $640 million for the running of the water system. Meanwhile, the comptroller for Puerto Rico had come out with a report showing that there were over 3,100 deficiencies in the running of the water system. You know, an official report that showed that that there were serious problems in the running of the water system.
In 2000, Vivendi Environmental secured a 20-year contract to provide drinking water treatment in Moncton, New Brunswick. Vivendi then attempted to take control of the city's water distribution system. The company also operates wastewater facilities in Goderich, Ontario.
There's nothing more refreshing than having a clear, crisp, clean glass of water.
That cool, refreshing drink.
Try it with your friends.
New world water makes the tide rise high. Come inland and make your house go by. Fools done upset the old man.
In August 2001, Toronto's Mayor Mel Lastman proposed that the city's water operations be handed over to an independent, arm's-length, unelected water board, a prelude to privatization. The plan was defeated by massive public opposition. 80% of the people polled were against the proposal. John Cartwright is president of the Toronto and York Region Labour Council. He spoke at a public meeting called to discuss the water board at Toronto City Hall in November 2002.
I started work on the tools at the age of 18 building this city. And in my mind, this is one of the most dangerous things that's ever been put in front of City Council. And I'm going to ask you some questions, Councillor Dugan. Because in August 2001... there was an article in the Globe and Mail, and you're quoted extensively. The headline is, Lastman Plots Water Overhaul. And it turns out that somebody in the city, in the mayor's office, had met with private operators who run water and sewage operations under contract in U.S. cities. And they told the city that, and I'm quoting here, privatizing the operations and maintenance would save millions of dollars. So I want an answer to two questions, Councillor. The first question is, who are those private operators that you or the mayor's office or others met with in the summer of 2001 who told you you should privatize? The second question, because this is what people in England have told us. They've told us, once you lose public services, you can never get them back. So I want to know from you, Councillor Dugan, if you ram this through City Council and you get your majority of vote, how are you going to guarantee the people of Toronto that if it goes wrong, we can get it back?
If you want to know what company it was that I met with some years ago,
you're part of the committee.
I'm just trying to think. There was. I've met in the past with a number of different companies, but the only one that I can recall is probably United Water. And I met with a representative from them about a year ago. Or no, actually, it was probably longer than that. And since that time, we've talked to our staff, and our staff basically said that some of the claims that were being made were ridiculous. That the savings they were talking about, much of which we pretty much thought we could probably achieve through our best practices and many of our other practices.
Arm's-length agencies were started in Britain, where Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher used them to carry out extensive privatization. John Cartwright describes.
In the United Kingdom, where Margaret Thatcher first started a process of privatization, and the first step that they did was to set up something called a quango, a quasi-non-governmental organization. And each of these quangos is an appointed board full of political appointees who aren't answerable to people, and they do most of their business behind closed doors. In England, the operations of almost all the water was handed over through by these quangos to private corporations, who some of them are now being gobbled up by multinationals from other parts of the world. And they did not do what they had said they would do when they came in and said, oh, we'll take care of the water and we'll do this kind of investment or the other kind of thing. None of those things happened. Instead, they just simply soaked the consumers. Mm-hmm. And water rates went through the roof.
Right.
And often they refused to put the investment back in that they had in fact committed to.
Privatization of water services in Britain led to price hikes of up to 142%. Profits shot up by 147% as 8,600 employees were laid off, 22% of the workforce. According to the Conservative Daily Mail newspaper, Britain's top 10 water companies have been able to use their position as monopoly suppliers to pull off the greatest act of license robbery in our history. Toronto's water operations are similarly lucrative.
And think about the numbers here. $19 billion worth of public assets is what is currently listed with our treatment plants, our purification plants, pumping stations and pipes. And the revenue today is over $500 million every year, and it's moving up. City Council last year voted on a 9% increase, is intending to do it again this year. The revenue will be over $750 million very shortly. Well, there are companies that would do almost anything, and in the world we've seen that, from bribery to outright corruption to fudging the books to fraud, in order to get their hands on $750 million of revenue every year.
The main reason given for privatization is lack of funds to maintain and expand the public water system. Dana Davis spoke at the Toronto Water Board meeting.
But I have to say, I'm not an expert in water. And I have to say, this entire report and this entire process has baffled me, as it has almost everyone I've spoken to. Why are they doing this? And I've tried to summarize your rationale. One, you don't have enough capital. Yes, but how is going to a water board going to bring capital? Is it going to fall out of the sky because you've got a water board? No.
Everywhere you pick up any reports where there's an attempt to privatize, that's the first thing that's said. We don't have the money to invest. And of course, when you say, well, at some point, somebody has to pay for all this, you run into the interesting dilemma that the privatizers have. And that is that if you're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in investing in infrastructure, the body that can cheapest fund that is a city, because they have the best interest rates available because of the credit rating. Much cheaper for the city to fund that infrastructure investment than it is for a private company, or for that matter, an arm's length semi-private or quasi-non-governmental organization, mm-hmm. all of whom pay higher interest rates in order to borrow for the construction of the treatment plants, the pipes, the sewer pipes, and so on.
The closest example of privatization for Toronto is Hamilton.
About 6 or 7 years ago, the sewer treatment plant in Hamilton was put under a public-private partnership in a company called Phillips, which is a Hamilton-based, originally a waste disposal company, and then it started doing demolition as well. And they took over the water treatment. Not long after they took over, they cut staff, they relaxed the standards that had been there before in order to meet greater efficiencies. And in the blink of an eye, there was a massive spill of raws of hundreds of thousands of liters of raw sewage spilled into Lake Ontario, into the Hamilton Harbour. And of course, the interesting thing is, it wasn't Phillips that was responsible for the financial liability, it was the taxpayer or the public. No. Phillips actually went bankrupt sometime later, and the contract was then handed over to a company called Azurix.
Mm.
Azurix has now gone bankrupt because Azurix was part of the Enron family of companies.
Right.
So you have organizations with the kind of moral and ethical lack of values that Enron has shown being given stewardship of our water systems. I think that's enough to frighten anybody.
The privatization of water has NAFTA implications. Once any part of a service sector is privatized, under NAFTA, the rest of the sector cannot be kept from corporations.
Well, one of the things that a number of environmentalists have raised at hearings that we've had now and in the public meetings that we've had is the danger under GATS and under NAFTA of the commodification of water and the provision of water, that once you move it from being a public monopoly into any form of commercial enterprise, then immediately you're required to open that up to the bidding and the interests of corporations from certainly the United States and elsewhere.
To avoid public panic and freaking, there are places where TB is common as TV, cause foreign-based companies go and get greedy. The type of cats who pollute the whole shoreline, have it purified and sell it for $1.25. Now the world is drinking it. Your mom's wife and baby girl is drinking it. Up north and down south is drinking it. You just have to go to your sink for it. The cash register is going to chink for it. Carbon monoxide, got the fish looking cockeyed. Used to be free, now of course you a fee, cause it's all about getting that.
The people of the city of Cochabamba in Bolivia waged the bravest and most successful struggle against water privatization, literally driving the multinational corporation involved out of the country in April 2000, and reclaiming their most precious resource at the cost of their lives. Bolivia is one of the poorest countries in South America. Karen Koch is the Water Project Coordinator for the Polaris Institute. She visited Bolivia at the end of 2002.
At the end of 1999, the government of Bolivia signed a contract for the privatization of the water supply of Cochabamba, which is the third largest city in the country. And they signed this contract with a consortium of investors, the largest of which was Bechtel Corporation, which is based out of the U.S. They signed a contract, a full privatization contract, for 40 years to manage and operate the water supply of the city. Included in that contract was a guaranteeing of 16% profits for Bechtel. Within a matter of months, there were massive, massive rate hikes. Bechtel had said that its water rates were going to increase by maximum 10% for the poorest people, and then for higher income users, they were going to increase much more. In effect, what happened was that among the poorest people in the city saw their rates go up by as much as 100% and 300% even in some cases within a matter of a month. So for the poorest families in the city, this meant spending more than half or three quarters of their income just on water. And if they couldn't pay their bills, what happened to most people is they were being cut off from their water supply. So the situation became very, very dire. And a group of civic organizations and unions and concerned folks came together to start to organize on how to wage a political campaign around the water tariffs specifically. So it started as a campaign around the tariff hikes, really, and then moved to a broader campaign around the privatization generally. So this coalition of groups, which was spearheaded by the factory workers' union in the city, started to put together a mobilization around the whole city that ended up in mid-January staging a general strike, a four-day-long general strike, that shut down the entire city, including road barricades and everything that works. The government agreed to sit down to negotiate with the leaders of this coalition.
Bolivia was ruled at the time by Hugo Banzer, an elected former army general. Banzer first came to power in Bolivia as a dictator in a CIA-sponsored coup marked by extreme violence. From 1971 to 1978, he ruled in collaboration with the United States, drug traffickers, and Klaus Barbie, the notorious Nazi mass murderer. The general was responsible for horrendous human rights violations. When faced with massive public opposition to water privatization, Banzer's government tried to brutally suppress it.
They had promised they were going to bring the tariffs back to what they used to be before and keep them frozen for a certain period of time. Within a matter of days, the government rescinded that promise, and protests started again. In February, there was a, a, sort of a peaceful march that was planned of thousands of people, and they were met with riot police. And there was extensive violence, lots of injuries. And over the course of the entire very pitched battle, over a matter of about 4 months, some estimates are saying that about 7 people died, and there were hundreds injured. One day in early April, they made a promise that they were going to cancel the contract, and the following day they declared martial law and arrested all the labor and union leaders, all the protest leaders, everybody. So it became really quite dramatic at that point. And then the government had to try and started a very elaborate PR campaign to try and debase what was going on in the streets. And there were accusations flying around that all the protests were being funded by the narco traffickers and I don't know what.
The privatization of water in Bolivia, as in many third world countries, was pushed by the World Bank. In 1998, the bank refused to guarantee a $25 million loan to refinance water services in Cochabamba unless the government sold the public water system to the private sector. Only Bechtel's bid was considered. Under World Bank pressure, the Bolivian government backed full-cost water pricing, pegged the cost of water to the U.S. dollar, and announced that none of the World Bank loan could be used to subsidize water for the poor. Permits had to be bought to access all water, even rainwater, and that from community wells.
Also, at this point, the World Bank became involved. Because people started pointing the finger also at the World Bank and the role that they had played in effect strong-arming the Bolivian government to privatize the water supply for the city, because it was in such dire need of capital and finances that they wouldn't extend any financing from the World Bank unless the system was privatized. So the finger started to be pointing at the three major players.
3 months after the start of their anti-privatization struggle, the people had won.
It was quite a victory for the privatization battle in Bolivia, on the continent, globally. And since then, it's been a long struggle for folks there to try and deal with a lot of the aftermath of the war that happened in 2000, in part because Bechtel is at the moment pursuing a lawsuit against the government of Bolivia for $25 million U.S. in lost profits for having canceled the water contract early. And also in part because the water utility, which Bechtel had purchased, has since been straddled with all of Bechtel's debts that it left behind once it left the country. So it's pretty mired in debt. And it's got a lot of the technical and management issues about the infrastructure, water scarcity, and these sorts of things that it's having to handle now with very, very little capital and a population that is very politicized around the issue of water and is demanding results soon.
In October 2003, the people of Bolivia won an even greater victory when they rose in rebellion and removed the government of President Sánchez de Lozada for attempting to first privatize and then sell and transfer the country's natural gas to the U.S. through Chile. 80 people were killed by Bolivian troops before de Lozada fled to Miami. The message of the Bolivian peasants and workers was clear. The resources of Bolivia are public and belong to the people of Bolivia. You've been listening to Conning the People, Privatization in Canada.
This series was written and researched by Asad Ismi.
Produced by Kristen Schwartz.
And executive producer Asad Ismi.
Narrated by Kristen Schwartz and Asad Ismi.
Funded by the Canadian Labour Congress, Canadian Union of Public Employees, Canadian Union of Postal Workers, Communications, Energy and Paper Workers, Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, and the Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association.
Thanks also to CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, Christiana Clemens for technical assistance,
and Wing Hong Si for sounds. Music credits for this segment: Money by Pink Floyd and New World Water by Mos Def.
For copies of this program, call 416-595-5068 or email news@ckln.fm.
Thank you for listening.